Gathering Mist. We have Kirk on the line, and as I understand it, Kirk, from Scott, you have a few questions that you would like. So this is going to be Stump the Yada.
Stump the Yada. Well, most of these are rather rhetorical when you think about it. But
okay, so you're saying what you're telling me is if these questions stump me, that I need another cup of coffee.
Well, that's probably just pour some more and keep going. So
okay.
You know, this weekend is wonderful, and it was also
tragic.
Sad, because every time you turn on something on television is Easter and so forth, and every time you...
Even at sporting events, they're kept on saying,
yeah,
you know, happy Easter,
yeah,
what a wonderful Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
And you just want to, it just, oh, makes me...
Well,
there's
the Easter bunny
on
the golf. Yeah, you got the Easter bunny all over the golf course, and, you know, like,
right,
come on, people, grow up.
Come on. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
How can how can so many people be so stupid?
Well, they obviously don't think it means anything one way or the other. Otherwise, half of them, I'm sure, would think again. But, you know, I wrote down...
Well, think again. Now, that's way too kind.
Is it?
Because that infers that the people celebrating Easter have thought in the first place.
Oh, well...
If they were thoughtful, they wouldn't
correct.
Be celebrating. They wouldn't be celebrating.
I stand corrected.
You know, we don't really have to. This is not a multiple thinking deal. The moment you start thinking, you stop being religious. So.
Well, you know, before I ask you the question, I'll toss out some things. One thing in particular, in Cora 23, you know, where it says you're summoned to these related appointment meeting times of Yahweh, not of the Jews, but of Yahweh.
Right, of Yahweh.
For the purpose of understanding, which certainly...
And by the way, the Hebrew word for understanding is bien. B-Y-N. Yeah. Now, let's just think of that for a moment. B-Y-N. And you know what the primary meaning of the word is understanding. You know what the secondary word meaning of that word is?
Not really.
Yeah. This happens to be, you know, the aha moments that you have along the way where you just say, oh, man, God is really, really smart. I recognized a long time ago, I don't claim to have many skills, but there's one thing I've always thought that I was pretty good at. There's only one thing I think I'm pretty good at. That doesn't mean I'm good at it, just so maybe I'm just, you know, flattering myself. There's one thing I think I'm pretty good at, which is I see the connections between things that most people miss.
Yeah.
And this transition from knowing to understanding is primarily by making connections between things, understanding the relationship between things, you know, cause and effect, for example.
Right.
So now that I've told you that the primary meaning of bien in Hebrew is to understand, you want to take a stab at what the secondary meaning of the word is?
How about make connections?
Between things, exactly.
Yes.
That's exactly what it means. So Yahweh is telling us in the Word what the process is to understanding, how you go about transitioning from knowing to understanding. It's by making connections. It's, you know, when you can look at things and filter out what's true, which is not true by probability, or you're able to say these things are consistent, these things are inconsistent. Consistent and inconsistent things don't fit together. You know, that's all by making connections. By associating Pesach with what Yahweh says it was for, which is to spare the lives of the firstborn children. And who was the firstborn child of Abraham, according to Yahweh?
Yishak.
Yeah, Yishak. Who was the first child of the covenant, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
After happiness.
So is to spare the firstborn children? I'm going to spare the children of the covenant. I mean, that's making a connection, isn't it? Now, if you don't connect those two stories, then you don't understand. So understanding is always by making connections. So Yahweh is telling us that these invitations that he's offering are designed to encourage us to understand by making connections between them and the covenant.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also, the family-oriented covenant is usually represented by a bee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
so,
I
by the way,
words,
so is
but I mean,
is,
I was just
so
like, I happen to know this one, so it was easy.
Mm-hmm.
But you have, if you connect the dots between the two things that are connected in the word, it's three letters. You've got a family, home, On one side of it, you have a yod, which represents Yahweh reaching down to help us, and you have an inheritance or the seed, not the seed, but the sperm again, which is the inheritance of the family.
Right.
And so you're connecting the home with them, connected by Yahweh. So
my conclusion, and I think you would concur with this. I am most certain Yahweh would concur with this. Once you come to understand the covenant, once you transition from knowing who Yahweh is, knowing what He is asking of us, knowing what He is offering to us, and you come to understand these things, then there isn't anyone who has transitioned to understanding who doesn't accept the deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best deal ever offered.
Absolutely.
You know, so since it's the best deal ever offered, there's not a single negative associated with the deal. It's not just positives. It's the most amazing positives that we can even fathom. So once you understand the covenant, you're part of the covenant. I mean, there's no one in this universe that has taken the time to and made the jump between knowing and understanding the covenant that isn't part of it. So bien is the perfect word to describe the pathway to being the child with an inheritance in Yahweh's family, lifted up by Yahweh's hand. I mean, that is the basis of the covenant. Understanding is the basis. And, Kirk, this is a big deal to me because the reason it's such a big deal to me is that I'm not a touchy-feely guy. Yahweh's not a touchy-feely God. We are both driven. His just happens to be incalculably superior to mine. But we're both driven by evidence and reason. We're both driven by you first got to come to know and understand before you should engage emotionally.
Sure.
And so when Yahweh bases the approach to His covenant on the Hebrew word for understand based on making connections, it's for me, it's like, oh, well, that's why Torah means teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the light goes off. It's so reassuring. It's so affirming. And all those people, you know, saying that, you know, that it's that they believe. And I'm saying, no, Yahweh has no use for belief. Understanding is the antithesis of belief.
Yeah. And you understand what you know.
That's right.
Hope.
Right. There's no faith. No faith, no belief, no hope. It's total and complete conviction and understanding. What a superior way that Yahweh has to go about it. And I was writing an agnostic over the weekend, and I said, you know, if you're an agnostic, chances are you like evidence and reason. And if you like evidence and reason, you will like Yahweh and His approach.
How did it go with him?
I left it with that we began this over an Easter conversation and on secularism and him talking about his background and and I said, listen, I'm going to lay it out who God is and what He wants and what He's offering, but to go any further, it has to be at your initiation. All I will tell you is that virtually everyone that I know, the vast majority of those that I know that are now part of the covenant, at some time in their life passed through agnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, so my guess is that, in fact, I can say with certainty, if you explore this, you'll come to like God and His approach. But it has to be at your initiation. So we'll see if he, I'll meet with him here later this week. We'll see if he initiates. If he doesn't, but my whole approach to this, and I'm glad we're talking about this because I get more letters on this than anything else.
Okay.
My approach is you throw out some hints.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody says Happy Easter, I'm not going to respond, yeah, Happy Easter to you. I'm going to say, no, I don't, nothing happy about Easter. I'm not going to celebrate it. And then I will throw out some hints that put them in a position that if they're interested, they will initiate a conversation. If they're not, I'm wasting my time. All I'm going to do is antagonize them to engage in conversation. So I always throw it out. It's their initiative, and I'll reinforce that in the discussion.
I'm totally on the same page. That's all you can do.
Okay, you're working towards a question, and I keep on interrupting.
Well, I was thinking over, you know, because of everything we hit upon that, so over the weekend and everything, and then I was thinking about Yahweh and Yahusha. Obviously, I mean, I don't want to sound ridiculous, but obviously there was never a time when they didn't endorse the Torah. They never changed their mind, and so forth.
Yahweh is the voice of the Torah. He is the Torah, and Yahusha is the living embodiment of the Torah. Mm-hmm. Yahusha was wholly and completely, irrefutably, Torah observant and Torah supportive.
Uh-huh. And they've asked you and I and everyone else mm-hmm. to Shemar Torah, right?
Right. To observe.
I mean, and mm-hmm. that message has never changed. They've never
right.
asked you to go anywhere else.
Right.
And then towards the end, and the description of the one that Christians call Antichrist,
mm-hmm.
Which is a terrible term because they should have called him what Yahweh called him, the Torahless one.
Correct.
Because that would define him.
Correct.
If you're Antichrist,
correct.
And you can define Christ, then your Antichrist
yeah.
can
see,
be
Christians can't call him the Torahless one because that would make them all qualified because they're all Torahless.
Yeah. Exactly. So I was just jotting down some names on rhetorically
uh-huh.
on who, if any of these people were pro the Torah. And obviously the first one I put on my list was the one who founded this religion called Christianity, Paul.
Yeah, and I think that Paul is actually the perfect, there's probably five or six people in human history that are ideal prototypes
mm-hmm.
for the Torahless one. If you want to know what the one the Christians call the Antichrist is going to be like, Paul, his ego, his statements, his whole approach, his personality, his issues, his style, every part of Paul is the epitome of what the Torahless one is going to be like.
Mm-hmm. Well, and continue on, if I may.
Okay.
So I went to all the religious leaders to influence all the people around the country because, you know, we're walking, we feel sometimes like we're, at least I do, I feel like I'm walking against this great windstorm. You know, I'm plodding away my way and everything is going the opposite direction. And so I was saying, well, where'd all this come from besides just Paul and old Babylonian stuff? And I hear your music, so if you want, we'll just continue.
Yeah, we'll continue after the break. We also have Glenn, and I'm sure he wants to contribute to this as well, so that'll be great. But, it is true that the one that the Christians call the Antichrist will be exactly like them because he will be Torahless, as are they. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Glenn on the line. Before, Kirk, you get your question posed, let's hear what Glenn has to say and respond to his either comment or question. Hello, Glenn.
Hey, Donna. Good morning, Kirk. Good morning, Donna. You guys are talking about understanding, and I wanted to, you know, put a point on that and illustrate the concepts a little bit. And this has come up before. We talked about, and just even the word understand, if you look up, it's one thing to, like, say, see a tree in the distance, but when you stand under the tree, you understand it. You're right up there, and you've got a close and personal. But more importantly, like, there's that notion of knowing a fact versus understanding it. And then furthermore, there's the distinction between knowledge and wisdom. And I was thinking a good metaphor for this is, it's one thing to know the level 5 hurricane, to see on the news that a level 5 hurricane is about to hit your area. It's another thing to understand, and basically, let's say understanding has to do with grasping the implications of a piece of knowledge, of a fact. In other words, you understand that the implications of a fact that a level 5 hurricane is coming, the implication is of what's going to happen is that you're going to have building damage and power outages, flooding, things like that. So you understand, you grasp the implications of what the facts mean. So, okay,
right.
Because this is true, this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. It implies, this fact implies that this is going to happen. Now, once you understand what is implied, then you have to make choices about what you're going to do. And choice making is the essence of wisdom. Okay, so there's knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Wisdom cannot be demonstrated apart from the making of choices. Okay, so you have the facts, you know the facts, You grasp their implications and thus they understand. And then once you understand, then you're able to employ, if you have wisdom and are not fool, then you can begin to make choices. So choice is the essence of wisdom. We know people are wise because of their personal histories and the choices they made. When we see people who have made wise choices, you know, make good choices, we say they are wise. So there's knowledge, understanding, and wisdom.
And the way that the covenant is set up, though, I mean, God, Yahweh doesn't ask you to know everything to start with. He wants you to start the dialogue. Start to understand, and then you make your decision. So that's absolutely accurate.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. It starts with knowledge, knowledge can lead to understanding.
Understanding has to do with the implications of facts, and wisdom has to do with choices made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I would go along with that, and that you would say in this regard that. Making a rational, moral, logical deduction from the evidence and your understanding of the evidence is what separates those who know from those who are wise.
Knowledge is just facts, and understanding has to do with knowing implications.
Yeah. Right. It's like scholars. Scholars know lots of facts, but they seem to possess very little understanding of them. And almost no wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you also spoke of about Yahweh, you know, being, you know, putting truth above feelings, if you will, you know. And
yes.
I bumped into a Christian friend of mine who's, I haven't seen her over 10 years over the weekend, and family's been through some tragic occurrences and stuff like that. And I started, you know, we were discussing, you know, being the Easter weekend, or they call it maybe Resurrection Sunday, if they're at least aware that your star is utterly pagan. And, you know, as I started to discuss these issues of, you know, about Yahweh and Yahusha's name and Passover and these sorts of things, and, you know, the deceptions that are, you know, foisted upon us by the church and stuff, this woman who is, you know, a very strong and caring person, psychosocially, you know, very strong, survived these things. And, but, you know, devout Christian, affiliated with a specific non-denominational group that's fairly large. But she's also like this very, you know, touchy-feely, you know, person. And she's, you know, and when confronted with doctrinal issues, she's like, oh, you know, like, well, I'm not feeling the love. It's all, you know, about love. And it's like, actually, you know, the truth comes. Truth is more important than the subjective personal feelings. She didn't like that concept. And she'd say, well, I'm glad I'm not where you are. And I'm like, again, which is, kind of a mean thing to say. I said, well,
faith and feelings are very similar concepts. Yeah, faith and feelings, very similar. And so many people justify their faith based on their feelings.
Yeah.
And yet, they haven't moved an iota from faith when they're dealing with their feelings. But yet their feelings are used to justify that which is without knowledge and understanding. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Glenn and Kirk on the line. Kirk, you were about ready to ask a question. We'll get Glenn's response to this as well.
Well, yeah, I was on my Torah list that I was making because I was defining. Obviously, we established. It's easy to establish that Yahweh and right through Yahusha comments are totally Torah oriented, and so I was going through the Torah list ones, and I started with Paul, and when Glenn called, I was starting to think about it. Also on my list right here was below Paul was the Billy Grahams and the Oral Roberts, and the I skipped to the 20th century to the local popes
right.
The 20th century, and even the mega churches like old Joel, what's his face, you know, with his mega church wherever it is.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In fact,
Rich Warren would be high on that list.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the guy that wrote Chris Lom as the integration of Christianity and Islam, and who favors himself a politico, and you know goes off to Washington to bask in the glow of the nation's capital. Yeah, he'd be high on that list. Jimmy Swaggart, James
Absolutely.
Baker. Yeah.
But as when Glenn called, and of course, when you think about it, without an emotional tug, without that emotional responsibility that doing speech making, and you've taken speech classes and you've read speech books. I have.
Yeah, I used to compete in speech. Yeah, I used to compete. Extemporaneous, impromptu, and debate.
Oh, debate.
Yeah, that was the. Well, I played every sport known to man in high school. The one sport, it's not really a sport, but the one thing that I actually excelled at, because I don't excel at much, was impromptu, extemporaneous speech, and because we used to eat and debate. Those were things that I had a proclivity for. So, yes, I've done them and enjoyed them. But in those things, emotion doesn't prevail. It is, if you look at those who have garnered an enormous base of support.
Yeah.
They all blend the written word and the spoken word, and they find that the spoken word is far more emotionally compelling. Adolf Hitler, for example, realized that Mein Kampf would provide a foundation for his new religion and his rise, but ultimately he was going to motivate people through the spoken word because it was much more emotional, and people don't think as much when the word is spoken to them.
Yeah, well, none of these empires, these little empires that these people have built, could possibly be without it.
Correct.
They just draw the crowd in, and
right.
And so, but my point.
Billy Graham with his unique accent and his style. Yeah, he was spellbinding in his presentation. People would go because he was so spellbinding because he had such a unique style. Adolf Hitler was able to mesmerize hundreds of thousands of people at an event with his rehearsed gestures and voice inflection. So yeah, it's very common throughout history.
So beyond a shadow of a doubt, these would fall in the category of the Thorless ones. Yet they Christians follow them by the millions and billions. I mean, it's just
Look at Paul you read his letters, when he was in front of a community of people, he was able through his preaching to persuade them. And then you read his letters and you find that the moment that his words were no longer reverberating in their heads, and they started to think that they all moved away from him. I mean, Galatians is written to a group of people who had listened favorably to Paul and then completely rejected him. I mean, he calls them every derogatory name under the book. I mean, he just despises the Galatians for turning on him. And if you read 1 and 2 Corinthians and 1 and 2 Thessalonians, Paul's first five letters were all written to people who had listened to him, and he had sensed that they were accepted what he said emotionally while he was talking to them. But then in his letters, he says, you know, what's wrong with you? You've abandoned what I've said because they didn't buy. And ultimately, you know, Paul died miserable and alone. And if it wasn't for other people taking his letters and emoting vocally about them, Christianity would never have existed.
No, but the same thing is true of the European or the English kings in particular are all sold on God and King. I mean, that's about as emotive term as you can come up with. I mean, to these people.
Why do you think that churches spend so much money creating this environment that instills confidence and that they create, you know, they have all the songs and the music and the preaching and the ceremony and these gorgeous buildings.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, we've been dead for a minute. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. So I said, you know, you think of Christianity. Why do they have these, you know, glorious, gold-clad, beautifully adorned, I think it's disgusting myself, but have all of these ceremonies and all of this music in these fancy buildings? Is it not to make people feel like they're being godly, like this is uplifting?
Sure. It's all salesmanship.
Right.
I mean,
I
mean, I can't find anybody that's the. I mean, until we get to the other side of the coin, there's everybody is totally against the Torah.
Now, I would ask you this question. Yahweh to articulate his Torah? Did he pick somebody who was slick of speech, who could turn a phrase and really wow the crowd?
No. No. Not if you talk about Moshe.
Yeah. He was a stutterer.
Guys, can I pardon? May I jump in for a second?
Sure.
Applying this to the conversation I had with his friend the other day, who, views everything through her very sort of I say there are like white collar pseudo intellectual know it alls, and there are blue collar anti intellectual know it alls, and then there's sort of just trying to be honest and intellectually honest in between. But she was like appealing to this simplicity thing and feeling the love and all that stuff. And so this issue of, you know, knowledge and truth versus this, the love thing. I want to make the point that certainly Yahweh is loving. There's no doubt that Yahweh is loving. Yochanan even goes so far as to say Theos Espen Agape, you know, God is agape love. But that's not our notion of love necessarily. You know, we kind of try to mitigate this with a term like tough love, for example. And, you know, so Yahweh's love is tough love that is based first in truth. You know,
right.
And when we think we know what we're talking about, and it can be hard to accept correction or accept the notions that our ideas are wrong. And so this woman was giving me this thing like, when confronted with doctrinal truths or logical truths or script, you know, Torah truths that people, you know, aren't prepared to really think about, they might say, oh, well, I'm not feeling the love. And, you know, what I thought relative to her is, that's the Beatles. All you need is love, and that's right. And the LGBT community, for example, would say to her, "Well, we're not feeling the love from you because you have all this icky poo Christian doctrine that says we have to be saved from sin and we have to believe in Jesus, and I'm not feeling the love because you're presenting me with ideas that are dissonant, creating dissonance for me."
Right.
So she didn't seem to grasp that some of her argument was based on specific things she seemed to be specific truths that come before the feelings. You know, so this all ties together. I mean, you know, Yahweh's instructions are truth, and, you know, and he provides them because he is loving.
Yeah. Is it possible to love a false god?
I would think so.
Sure. You can love a tree.
Muslims love Allah, because Allah's not lovable. But the Christian Jesus is a lovable fellow. And it's this false god. But Christians emote genuine love for this false god. Don't you think that throughout human history, humans showed a degree of loving devotion to all the various false gods? I mean, there was a lot of really cute, nice ones.
I can illustrate the implications of this very powerfully as a nurse.
Okay.
There are a great many people who love their family members dearly. Mm-hmm. And because they don't grasp truth, they submit them to treatment regimens which harm or kill them. Because because they lack truth, but they do what they do in love and end up with a negative outcome.
Right, as opposed to understanding. Knowledge and understanding. Exactly. Well, that's a beautiful example. And so what Yahweh, to preclude that, says that first he wants us to come to know him. The whole purpose of the Torah is to introduce himself to us. So we come to know him as he really is, and then he wants us to understand what he's offering and how to participate in what he's offering. So you make the transition from knowing to understanding to wisdom, which is acting upon the understanding in an appropriate way. That's what Yahweh wants. And once you come to know him, and once you come to understand what he's offering, and once you choose to engage in it, then you fall in love. But you ought not fall in love before you know who it is that you're talking with.
Right.
So Christianity puts the faith and the feeling before knowledge. And today, you know, it's like Teo, the linebacker from Notre Dame, that fell in love with a guy who was pretending to be a girl online. Had a love affair with an imaginary person. It happens all the time in religion.
But conversely, if these are these people who we've been talking about in the followers, or these are the people that have been using that emotive or that emotional tug, their hook, to find a following. You don't find that really. I'm not aware that we find that in Abraham or Moshe. I mean,
No, we don't.
Hook there. I mean,
no, I don't see. Do you see one place where Abraham says that? Oh, I dearly love God. Oh, how much I love God. Do you ever find from Sarah? Oh man, I just really love you, God. Mm-hmm. You ever once read that?
Well, it's certainly not couched in the terms that we use.
No. I mean, Yahweh tells us all about his conversations with Abraham and with Sarah and his interactions with them. Everything he has to say is guidance. Mm-hmm. It's revelation and guidance. He never once tells us, I just love that guy. And he never has Abraham or Sarah, boy, I really love that God. Ever?
No.
So for participating in the covenant, love is not required. Now, Yahweh says, you know, we ought to prioritize coming to know and love him. But, you know, you do that by first coming to know who he is so that you can actually love him as opposed to some myth, some false impression of who he is. Welcome back to the last segment of Shattering Myths. Kirk, I think you're right. Everyone that you have listed will definitely serves as a model for the Torahless one. Glenn, you're right in that very few religious people have ever transitioned from knowledge and understanding to emotion, but instead reinforce their faith with emotion and never get beyond it.
And I'd like to point out that much of the way you convey Yahweh's motivation, his concern, is in the model of parental love. Well, parental love is concerned with having a child, leading, keeping your child safe, imparting knowledge and understanding and wisdom to the child for their own well-being.
Right. And do you show a child love by coddling it in such a way that it has no hope of ever being independent and being able to make good choices on his or her own?
Negative. You want to facilitate their growth and responsibility.
Correct. And you can facilitate their growth and responsibility by teaching them. That's why Yahweh began his introduction to us in a book called Teaching. Yeah, it may be among the top priorities, if not the top priority, in raising a child, is teaching that child so that they're equipped to understand, to make good choices. Well, what thing is more important? I mean, other than feeding them so they don't starve and putting a shelter over their heads so they are out of harm's way, what is more important than teaching that child?
And unfortunately, putting a roof over their head and taking care of them is precisely what the state wants the function of the parent to be, while the state provides all ideological indoctrination.
Yes, correct. That is correct. And then it gets back to what I think is the most popular religion in the world today, which is social secular humanism, in the sense that while it does not have a god, Buddhism doesn't have a god either, serves as a religion in the sense that it has indoctrination, it has its doctrine, it has its moral code, it has its sense of how people should respond and what is considered a value versus being caustic to society. So, it's extraordinarily judgmental, this socialist secular humanism, and that's what the state wants to indoctrinate most people in. And what it has rendered them, by the way, Kirk and Glenn, is incapable of making the transition from knowledge to understanding, and completely bankrupts their capacity for wisdom.
Now, is that the prerequisite for all of these things? Otherwise, the con job can't work.
That's correct. Yeah, you have to think your way to God. It's just all there is to it. You have to think your way to God. He laid it out that way. And he did so because he wants to spend eternity with people who enjoy thinking. That doesn't say you have to be particularly smart. No. It just says you have to enjoy the process of thinking.
Well, that's
and if you don't enjoy the process of thinking, he says, he's just letting you know you don't belong in heaven because you're going to hate the place. So it's God's idea of fun is doing the same thing that I viewed as fun with our children. We would go take vacations that were educational trips. Now, we did all the fun stuff on them. But going off and doing things and exploring with your children is the stuff that you remember. That's the fun stuff. That's what Yahweh wants to do with us.
Yeah.
And do you think he wants to be around somebody who would say, no, let's just wallow in emotion?
Right, exactly. One last thing before I go here.
Yeah.
I had an interesting weekend deliberately, like having conversations with people. I had three very edifying conversations with these people, deliberately going to the effort to repudiate, refute, revile the paganity of the Easter holiday. It was really liberating.
Wow.
You know, it's like, look, Tony's saying, I can't stand this anymore. I mean, the word Easter, the name of a pagan goddess, just like you said, it makes
right.
me cringe. It's just really, I can't,
right.
I just cannot, like, just right. kind of go along.
And the fact that it's a Sunday and that it's a Babylonian
the
religious
Sunday.
Ceremony.
Right.
And not even disguised. Right. Not even disguised. And the fact that it's used as a counterfeit for Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. I mean, wow.
It's ridiculous.
The fact that it has an egg-laying bunny that came right out of the pages of the Babylonian religion. The fact that it has an Easter ham that came right out of the pages of the Babylonian religion. I mean, you can't be more pagan than Easter Sunday. With Easter bunnies.
I did eat some ham, I must admit. I'm sorry about that.
That's funny. Eat whatever you're thoughtful about. Just don't do it in a religious setting. Thank you, guys. We'll be with you tomorrow. May God bless.